Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
We're launching a free new Aquinas 101 digital platform. Dive into the world of St. Thomas Aquinas with a customized learning environment, certificates of achievement, interactive elements, and a redesigned digital Summa Theologiae featuring a side-by-side Latin to English translation. To be notified when the platform goes live, sign up at go.thomisticinstitute.org/new-aquinas-101. That's go.thomisticinstitute.org/new-aquinas-101.
Just before I get started, just a few points of terminology, because I realize people are from very different backgrounds here. A distinction between validity and soundness, because I'm going to be talking about arguments, and sometimes I'm going to be saying that an argument is valid, and by saying it's valid, I don't mean that it is necessarily a good argument. I just mean that it's an argument where the conclusion follows from the premises. One or more of the premises might be false. So valid doesn't mean the way it often does on the street, just good. I've used the word sound for an argument that is valid and has true premises, okay? This talk is going to deal a lot with questions about whether certain phrases, like the ones I have in quotation marks over there, God, God's act of creating Alpha, God's wills Alpha, what those phrases designate, what they refer to in reality. This is something that's come up in other talks, but just to be aware that there's going to be this question that's often going to come up is whether or not this a particular phrase, what it applies to in the real world, and when it applies to those things, okay? And apologies to those who need the apologies, but I'm going to be using the language of possible worlds some in this talk, but I don't mean that in an ontologically loaded way. I don't mean that there really are possible universes out there other than this universe. It's just a handy way and one that's become fairly entrenched in contemporary philosophy for thinking about alternative possible states of affairs. So I'm here giving this talk, but I think I could have been not here. I could have been in at home in St. Paul, Minnesota, if I hadn't been invited to come give the talk or if I had something else keeping me there, right? So in the contemporary lingo, we might say, you know, there's a possible world, sounds like, in which I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota right now. That's just another way of saying I could be in Minnesota. So anybody, any of you who think that things could be otherwise than they are now, right, think that there are, in this way of speaking, possible worlds in which things are that way. But it doesn't mean like, you know, you can get in a spaceship or something and travel to those worlds or anything like that. Okay. That's just by way of background and caution, and then I'll get started here. All right. So traditional Christian teaching maintains that although God created the universe, he might have created a different universe or no universe at all. At the First Vatican Council, for example, the Catholic Church anathematized the following proposition, something along the lines of, let anyone who says that God did not create by his will, free from all necessity, but instead as he necessarily loves himself, let him be anathema, let that claim be anathematized. So it's the church rejecting that claim, and it's an example of the traditional teaching concerning divine freedom. God, so the council seems to be saying, may love himself necessarily, but it is an error to say that God creates necessarily. God creates freely. Although God created this universe, call it Alpha, he might have created a different universe, Beta. So you see Alpha and Beta on the board. So there's a possible world in which God creates Beta rather than Alpha, right? Even though he in fact created Alpha. Or he might have refrained from creating altogether, right? This world here where you've got God and nothing else. So for a classical Christian author who articulates this traditional view, one need look no further than Aquinas. On numerous occasions in various writings, St. Thomas denies that God created of necessity while affirming that God's power extends to anything that is absolutely possible. by which Aquinas means that God's power extends to any state of affairs that does not involve a contradiction. From these points, Aquinas concludes that God could have made all sorts of things he has not in fact made. Thus, whether and what God creates is a matter of choice. As Aquinas puts it, quote, numerous entities non-existent in the order of reality are subject to the divine power. Now, whoever does some of the things that he can do, leaving others undone, acts by choice of his will, not by necessity of nature, end quote. St. Thomas gives many interesting arguments for the claims that God does not create necessarily, that God's power extends to all that is absolutely possible, and that whether and what to create is a matter of God's free choice. Although the arguments are worth exploring, my task today will be to consider whether these traditional claims about divine freedom are consistent with the equally traditional doctrine of divine simplicity. First, I will explain why divine simplicity, in particular as it is understood by St. Thomas, appears to rule out divine freedom and God's ability to do otherwise. I will then present an argument that will need to be rejected by anyone who wishes to preserve divine freedom alongside divine simplicity. The argument will facilitate our distinguishing three possible approaches to holding the traditional claims together. As the discussion progresses, I will make a case both on Thomistic and speculative grounds for the approach I prefer. Okay, so section two, the apparent conflict. For Aquinas, to affirm that God is simple is to deny composition in him. It is to deny that God is a composite or has component parts, where a component part is any part, element, or entity from which a thing is made or composed. Now, were God's act of creating this universe, we'll call it Alpha, were it an accident in God, distinct from the divine substance, then it would be very easy to make sense of God's creating a different universe, say, Beta, or no universe at all. In such a case, the numerically same divine substance would exist, but would lack the accident of causing Alpha, perhaps having no creating accident, or perhaps having the accident of creating Beta instead. The problem with this picture, of course, is that divine simplicity rules out God's having accidents. And the reason for this, which we probably know by now, is that, as Aquinas and many others have understood them, accidents are component parts of the things to which they belong, parts that enter into the metaphysical makeup or composition of the thing. If God were to have an accident, he would thus be a composite being, derived in some way from and depending on the parts, substance, and accident of which he is composed. But it's impossible that God be derived from or exist in dependence on anything. Indeed, this impossibility is the whole reason for affirming divine simplicity in the first place. And the same sort of argument could be run in terms of God's being pure act. God is simple, he's pure act. If God has an accident, he's not pure act, so God has no accidents. As it turns out, Aquinas thinks that not just accidents, but any sort of entity intrinsic to but not identical to God would imply composition in God. As a result, he maintains that whatever is intrinsic to God is simply identical to God. Or as he puts it in the Summa, quote, nothing that exists in God can have any relation to that wherein it exists or of whom it is spoken, except the relation of identity. And this by reason of God's supreme simplicity, end quote. Not only then does divine simplicity preclude identifying God's act of creating Alpha with an accident in God, but there could be nothing at all in God with which to identify God's act of creating Alpha other than God himself. Indeed, in a number of places, we find Aquinas apparently identifying all of God's activity with God, including God's activity of bringing things about. As he puts it in one place, quote, the multifarious actions attributed to God, as understanding, willing, producing things, and the like are not diverse realities, since each of these actions in God is his very being, which is one and the same. End quote. But herein lies the apparent conflict. Simply to identify God's act of creating Alpha with God would seem to preclude God's ability to do otherwise. For, given that God exists necessarily, if God's act of creating Alpha is identical to God, then it looks like God's act of creating Alpha will exist necessarily as well. Moreover, if creating Alpha is identical to God, it would seem impossible for this same God to exist without creating Alpha. The doctrine of divine simplicity, then, seems to force Aquinas into a metaphysics of divine action that is incompatible with what he wishes to affirm about divine freedom. The objection is part of a family of arguments against divine simplicity, sometimes called modal collapse arguments, since they attempt to show that divine simplicity entails a modal collapse on which God's act of creating and creation itself, the creation itself, exists necessarily. We can formalize, or at least set out, the foregoing version of the modal collapse argument, the one I just went through informally. We can do so as follows. Premise one, necessarily God exists. Two, God is identical to God's act of creating Alpha. And so three, necessarily God's act of creating Alpha exists. What to make of this argument? Christopher Tomaszewski has done us the service of pointing out that, as it stands, the foregoing argument is invalid. The conclusion doesn't follow from the premises. Indeed, it embodies a pattern of inference that logicians have recognized as invalid for some time. To use Tomaszewski's updated example from Quine, from the fact that 4, necessarily 8 is greater than 7, and 5, the number of planets is identical to 8, it does not follow that 6, necessarily the number of planets, is greater than 7. Neither, then, does 3 follow from 1 and 2 of the modal collapse argument. So is this point enough to put to bed the modal collapse argument? Section 3, a revised modal collapse argument and the questions it raises. As Tomaszewski points out, the foregoing arguments, though not valid as they stand, could be made valid by prefixing a necessity operator onto premises 2 and 5 of those arguments. If you do that, we can revise the modal collapse argument to render it valid as follows. So now we get 7, necessarily God exists. 8, this is the revised version of the premise from the previous argument, necessarily God is identical to God's act of creating Alpha. And so 9, necessarily God's act of creating Alpha exists. Now, I take it that proponents of divine simplicity, along with virtually all theists, will agree with 7. And with a possible caveat that emerges below, I take it that 9, the conclusion, is incompatible with the traditional understanding of divine freedom articulated at the beginning of this paper. Thus, it seems that the proponent of divine simplicity who affirms the traditional view of divine freedom is going to have to reject premise 8. What interests me, and what I want to spend the bulk of our time talking about, is how the proponent of divine simplicity might reject 8. To facilitate that discussion, I want to present an argument for the truth of 8. I'll call it the argument for 8, because I'm not very creative, that I believe to be valid. Assuming its validity, the proponent of divine simplicity and divine freedom will have to reject one of the argument for 8's premises in order to escape the modal collapse argument. And what I want to ask is, which premise should he or she reject? And which premise does Aquinas reject? So the argument for 8 runs as follows. Premise 10, God, okay, a term, God designates rigidly. Premise 11, God's act of creating Alpha designates rigidly. Premise 12, God is identical to God's act of creating Alpha. 13, true identity statements, in which a rigid designator appears on one side of the identity sign, are necessarily true if and only if a rigid designator appears on the other side as well. Therefore, 8, necessarily God is identical to God's act of creating Alpha. So some preliminaries, because there's some, you know, technical terminology in here. So to say that a term or phrase like God or God's act of creating Alpha, to say that it designates rigidly is to say that it designates or picks out or refers to or names the same object in all possible worlds, all possible scenarios in which that object exists, and that it never designates any other object. So it designates originally a word like God if it designates the same object in all possible worlds in which that object exists and never designates any other object. So that's one preliminary. Another, although I'm not a logician, I believe that premise 13 articulates a widely recognized principle in modal logic and the logic of identity. At least in what follows, I will take the truth of 13 for granted. And with that, the validity of this argument, that the conclusion follows from the premises, seems apparent. If that's right, then to avoid the conclusion at 8, the proponent of divine simplicity will need to reject either premise 10, premise 11, or premise 12. And remember, a lot hinges on this. A lot hinges on the truth of 8. For given that God exists necessarily, if 8 is true, it implies that God's act of creating Alpha, this universe, exists necessarily, in which case, presumably, God could not have done otherwise than create Alpha. So we need to figure out a way to block this argument, and it looks like the options are to reject premise 10, 11, or 12. So let's turn to the first option, rejecting premise 10. Rejecting 10 is, I think, a bad approach. When we say that God exists necessarily, for example, I think we mean that the very object we call God exists in all possible worlds, or the very object we call God exists in all possible scenarios. There's no possible scenario in which that the object that we call God doesn't exist. I take it that's what we mean when we say God exists necessarily. I don't think we mean merely that in all possible worlds, some object or other plays the role of God, and so is designated by that name. And if that's right, I think we need to reject 10. What 10 is allowing is the possibility that the G's across these different possible scenarios don't actually refer to the same object, right? So the God who created Alpha here is not the same God, right, who in some other possible scenario creates Beta. To reject 10 would have that implication. Yeah. Oh, okay. And another implication. So of rejecting 10 that makes me think it's a bad approach. Consider the traditional view endorsed by Aquinas that God could have refrained from creating or could have created any state of affairs that is possible. This claim, I take it, means that the very object, right, the very object we call God, the one who created this universe, the one who created Alpha, could have refrained from creating or could have created Beta or any other possible universe. It thus entails that God, right, that God designates this same object that in some possible world is not creating and that is creating in all the other possible worlds where God is creating different universes. So these claims about God are true, it seems to me, only if 10 is true. And thus the option of rejecting 10, rejecting the argument for 8 by rejecting premise 10, I think would undermine the traditional view that God could have done otherwise, really every bit as much as the argument from 8 would itself, or for 8 would itself, were it sound. Okay, so the option of rejecting 10 seems to be a bad option. The options of rejecting 11 and 12 require more discussion. But in order to set that discussion up, a brief pause to introduce some more terminology. So section four, the intrinsic-extrinsic distinction. Now, this is a distinction that has come up already some in Professor Brower's and maybe other talks as well, but let me just get this out there. So in this brief section, I want to draw a distinction between intrinsic and extrinsic predications and between intrinsic and extrinsic entities. Intrinsic predications characterize an object in virtue of how the object exists in itself. Extrinsic predications characterize an object not in virtue of how it exists in itself, but in virtue of its relations or lack of relations to things that fall outside the object. So Ginger is female is an intrinsic predication, as is Ginger has a golden coat, the name of my late golden retriever. Those are intrinsic predications. Ginger is a beloved pet is an extrinsic predication, since it characterizes Ginger in terms of a relation to those who love her and is true not simply because of the way Ginger is in herself, but because of how things stand outside of Ginger. The truth value of an intrinsic predication cannot change without the subject of that predication either changing or ceasing to exist. If it ceases to be true that Ginger has a golden coat, it will either be because Ginger has ceased to exist or because she has undergone a change in her coat's color or lost her coat altogether. The truth value of an extrinsic predication, at least typically, can change without the subject's changing or ceasing to exist. So Ginger may cease to be a beloved pet without any change in Ginger at all. For example, if all those who adore her were killed in a tragic accident. The term merely Cambridge change has entered the philosophical lexicon to name those cases in which a predication comes to be true or ceases to be true of an object in virtue of a change in the object's relations to things outside itself without the object changing or ceasing to exist in itself. By contrast, an object undergoes a real change, as opposed to just a Cambridge change, if and only if it is in itself actually different after the change than it was before. The distinction between real and merely Cambridge change can help elucidate the distinction between entities that are intrinsic to an object and entities that are extrinsic to that object. An entity is intrinsic to an object if and only if the entity's ceasing to exist or ceasing to belong to the object would of itself constitute either the object ceasing to exist or the object's undergoing a real change as opposed to a merely Cambridge change. If an entity is not intrinsic to an object, then it's extrinsic to the object. So the question to ask whether an entity is intrinsic to an object or not is, would the entity ceasing to exist, would it involve that object's either ceasing to exist or undergoing a real change? If it is, it's that entity is intrinsic with respect to that object. If it's not, then the entity is extrinsic with respect to the object. So now to a consideration of premises 11 and 12. So section 5, rejecting premise 11, the identity approach. To hold 11, to affirm premise 11, that God's act of creating Alpha designates rigidly, is to hold that phrase, God's act of creating Alpha, that it designates the same object in every world in which that object exists, and that it never designates any other object. I don't know of anyone who wants to reject premise 11 on the grounds that in some possible world, God's act of creating Alpha designates some object other than the object that it designates in the actual world. On the other hand, I think it is fairly common for proponents of divine simplicity to reject 11 on grounds that in other possible worlds, the object designated by the phrase God's act of creating Alpha, that object exists in other possible worlds, but that the phrase God's act of creating Alpha does not designate this object in those other possible worlds or scenarios. What these proponents of divine simplicity who would reject premise 11 say is that God's act of creating Alpha designates or refers simply to God. That's what it refers to. That's what it designates. But it does not refer to God in worlds in which it is not true that God is creating Alpha. Okay, well, you might ask, well, what in reality makes it true that God is creating Alpha? It can't be simply God or the divine substance, since God or the divine substance is a common denominator between the scenario in which it's true that God is creating Alpha and worlds in which it's not true. So it's not God that determines whether or not it's true that God is creating Alpha. Rather, on this approach, what makes it true that God is creating Alpha is that God has the effect, Alpha, related to God by a relation of causal dependence. In worlds where God does not have the effect Alpha, it's not true that God is creating Alpha. And so the phrase, God's act of creating Alpha, does not designate God in those worlds. You could also think about this in terms of just the title creator, right? Does the title or name creator, what does it refer to? Well, it refers to or names God, but does it name God in all possible worlds? Well, somebody might say, no, it only names God in the worlds where there's an actual creation, right? Well, the same thought is here, right? God's act of creating Alpha only names God in worlds where, you know, where Alpha exists, right? So let me employ the terminology introduced in the previous section. To use the terminology introduced above, on this approach that we're considering now, the object that God's act of creating Alpha designates is intrinsic to God, since that object is simply God himself. That's what God's act of creating Alpha designates, God, so it's intrinsic to God. But the truth that God is creating Alpha is extrinsic, since whether or not it is true depends on God's relation or lack thereof to entities outside God. In particular, whether God has a relation to Alpha, or rather Alpha a relation to God. Thus, the predication God creates Alpha is an extrinsic predication, but God's act of creating Alpha itself is simply God, and so is intrinsic to God. God's act of creating Alpha then is intrinsic to God, but the claim that God creates Alpha is an extrinsic predication. Note that this approach which rejects premise 11, fits very comfortably with the affirmation of premise 12. God's act of creating Alpha is identical to God. The object it names or designates is nothing other than God himself. But it is not necessarily identical to God, for it does not designate God in worlds where Alpha is not God's effect. The foregoing approach appears to be the one favored by Tomaszewski, or is at least wonderfully articulated by him. He writes, quote, "While God's act is indeed intrinsic and therefore identical to him, God's act of creation designates that act, designates it, not how it is in itself, but by way of its contingent effects. That is, whether God's act of creation designates God's act depends on the existence of a creation which is contingent, and so the designation is not rigid. And since the designation is not rigid, the identity statement is not necessary, as it must be in order to validate the argument for modal collapse." Indeed, I think a lot of Thomists follow this approach, and one major reason is that it upholds the identity between God and God's action that Aquinas seems to affirm in so many passages, such as the one quoted earlier in this paper. Let us therefore call this approach the identity approach. How to evaluate it? Although I think this approach far preferable to the approach that would reject premise 10, I think it would be preferable still to affirm both 10 and 11 and to reject premise 12. Let me express what I take to be some drawbacks of the identity approach. As a preparation for considering these drawbacks, notice that it follows from divine simplicity, I take it anyway, that God is intrinsically the same across all possible worlds, all possible scenarios. For the only way God could differ across worlds the only way God could be different intrinsically, would import composition into God. For example, by introducing different accidents had by God in different worlds. Now, if God is the same across worlds, and all of God's activity just is God, then it seems that all of God's activity will be the same across worlds. At least unless there's some basis for thinking otherwise. Looks like God's activity will be the same across worlds if God is identical to God and God is simple. This result will apply as much to God's activity of knowing and willing as it does to God's activity of creating. Granted, proponents of the identity approach will say that the divine activity is designated differently in different worlds. In the actual world, the divine activity is designated, the act of creating Alpha, willing Alpha, etc. Whereas in some possible world, it's designated the act of creating Beta and the act of willing Beta. But these differences in designation are due to God's activity having different effects in these worlds, effects that are extrinsic to that activity, that are outside that activity, if you will. God's activity itself will be the same. Now, let me be clear that I agree that God is the same, that God is the same across worlds, despite differences in his effects. But here's where I'm getting into drawbacks or concerns about the identity approach. And to begin, it just sounds odd to me to say that God's activity, his willing, his creating, his knowing, is the same across worlds where his effects differ. It seems strange also to say that the truth values of propositions about God's activity vary wildly across possible worlds or possible scenarios, yet that God's activity itself varies not at all. It seems, moreover, incongruous to hold that all the differences between a world in which God wills and creates the universe and a world in which he doesn't, that all the differences between those two scenarios are extrinsic to God, yet to claim that God's act of willing and creating the universe are intrinsic to him. In addition to these oddities, let me state what seem to me three more counterintuitive implications of the identity approach. First, it seems that God's act of creating ought to be able to serve as the truth maker for the proposition God creates Alpha. It just seems like the thing that is God's act of creating Alpha ought to be able to make true the claim God creates Alpha. But on the identity approach, it can't. A truth maker necessitates the truth it makes true. But on this approach, God's act of creating Alpha does not necessitate the truth God creates Alpha, since this act is nothing other than God, who exists in many worlds, in many possible scenarios in which it's not true that God creates Alpha. Second, on the identity approach, God's act of creating Alpha exists necessarily, since it is nothing other than God who exists necessarily. Granted, God's act of creating Alpha doesn't exist necessarily under that designation of creating Alpha, but God's act of creating Alpha itself does exist necessarily, since it's just God. And this seems to be not what I would like to say. It seems when asked whether God's creating Alpha exists necessarily, it would seem preferable to be able to answer a simple no. Third, if God's activity is the same across worlds, then strictly speaking, God couldn't have done or acted otherwise, despite what we normally want to say. Indeed, it would be strictly false to say that God does or acts differently, even in the world where he doesn't create anything. We could say on the identity approach that the same activity that God is might have had different doings in the sense of different effects, or that the same activity that God is might have had no effects, but that God could literally have done, acted otherwise, requires that God's activity actually differs in some other possible world, it would seem. Now, I acknowledge cases where the designation of an activity depends on effects extrinsic to that activity that have a contingent relationship to that activity. For example, following up on sister's baseball analogies, the swing of a baseball bat is designated hitting a home run only if the ball flies over the fence after being hit. There's a possible world in which the same swing exists but is not designated a home run because the center fielder snags the ball just before it clears the fence. So there are cases like this, to be sure. Still, God's act of creating Alpha doesn't seem to be like these sorts of cases. Hitting a home run is not a basic action, but an action performed by means of some other action, swinging the bat, which may not bring about the home run if something, for instance, a center fielder interferes. But there's good reason to suppose that an act of creation is a basic action, one in which God brings about his effect directly and not by means of some other action. And it doesn't seem that a basic causal act can exist at all unless the effect brought about in the action exists, in which case the relationship between a basic causal act and the effect brought about in the act cannot be contingent. To this consideration, we might add that it would seem strange if God's act of creating Alpha were the sort of thing, like the act of hitting a home run, that might have been interfered with, such that it would not have been the act of creating Alpha. So in short, although I recognize cases in which the designation of an activity depends on effects extrinsic to that activity and having a contingent relationship to that activity, it doesn't seem to me that God's act of creating Alpha is that type of act. Let me conclude this section by saying that I do not claim these objections to be fatal. If I had to choose between accepting the identity approach or denying divine simplicity or divine freedom, I'd accept the identity approach. One reason I think the objections aren't fatal is that some of the objections are almost amount sort of, this sounds strange to me, this sounds odd to my ear, not the kind of what I would like to say, but I'm prepared to say that talk about God may sound strange to us sometimes. God is not, you know, is different than us. So I don't take these to be fatal. That said, I think there's a way to defend divine simplicity and freedom without what seem to me to be the oddities or drawbacks of this approach. And so to that alternative, I want to now turn. So section 6, rejecting 12, extrinsic divine agency. As mentioned above, one reason many Thomists endorse the identity approach is that it fits well with, and may even seem required by, those passages in which Aquinas appears to identify all of God's activity with God. Passages such as the one quoted above, read it again, the multifarious actions attributed to God, as understanding, willing, producing things, and the like are not diverse realities, since each of these actions in God is his very being, which is one and the same. That seems to give the Thomist reason to accept, endorse the identity approach. Yet, these passages do not reflect Aquinas' complete account regarding the location of God's contingent action. This textual point is most readily seen when it comes to God's act of creating. For, in other passages, Aquinas distinguishes between what he calls creation taken actively and creation taken passively. Creation taken actively, he tells us, consists simply in God, the divine substance. Creation taken passively, on the other hand, consists in the creature's real relation of dependence on God as the source of the creature's existence. Aquinas does not, or at least as far as I know, does not explain precisely what he means by distinguishing creation in this way. Presumably, he does not mean to be picking out two separate acts of creation. Some Thomists interpret creation taken actively to refer to God's actual act, actio, of creation, with creation taken passively, referring only to the creation, as in the effects being created. On this reading, on this interpretation, God's act of creation turns out to be simply identical to God, in line with the identity approach. Yet a problem with this reading, in addition to introducing the drawbacks of the identity approach mentioned above, is that this reading is directly opposed by other texts. For there are passages in which, while clearly talking about creatio as God's act, Aquinas characterizes it in precisely the way he does creation taken passively. Thus at Summa Contra Gentilis, Book 2, Chapter 17, he speaks of, quote, God's action, which is called creation. So it makes it clear that what he's talking about is God's act of creation. And then he goes on in the following chapter to say that this creatio, quote, is not a change, but the very dependency of the created act of being upon the principle from which it is produced, i.e. God. And thus creation is a kind of relation, so that nothing prevents its being in the creature as its subject. What this passage indicates is that when Aquinas talks about creation taken passively and identifies it as the creature's relation of dependence on God, he is not simply talking about the creation in the sense of the effects of God's act. He is talking about God's action, the actio of creation itself. But what then is the point of the distinction between creation taken actively and creation taken passively? In my view, the actively-passively distinction is best understood as telling us what is involved on the side of the agent, God, and what is involved on the side of the patient, the creature, in a single act of creation. On the side of God, what is involved is simply God, or the divine substance. Given divine simplicity, there is nothing else that the act of creation could involve on God's side. On the side of the creature, what is involved is the creature's real relation of dependence on God. Taken as a whole, the act of creation involves both. Given this interpretation, we can assume that in places where Aquinas identifies God's creative and causal act with God, he is not referring to the act of creation taken as a whole, but rather to that act taken actively, that is, to what God's causal act involves on the side of God. But since there is more to God's creative act than what it involves on the side of God, it does not follow from the fact that all that belongs to God's creative act on the side of God is the divine substance, that God could not have done otherwise when we consider his creative act taken as a whole. If God creates or causes alpha, that causal act involves not only God, to which creation taken actively refers, but also alpha, and alpha's relation of dependence on God, to which creation taken passively refers. Had God created beta instead, his act as a whole would have been different, for it would have included not alpha and alpha's dependence relation, but beta and beta's dependence relation. Notice, moreover, that the differentiating element in these creative acts is located extrinsic to God in the effects relation of dependence on God. Indeed, on the approach in question, God's creative acts as a whole are extrinsic to God, not intrinsic. Let us then call the approach under consideration the extrinsic approach and compare it to the identity approach discussed above. On the identity approach, all of God's activity is identical to God and therefore intrinsic to God. Yet, whether God is designated, God's act of creating alpha, or any other sort of act bearing on creatures, depends on whether the appropriate divine effects exist in the world in question. Thus, even though all of God's activity is intrinsic to God, on the identity approach, truths such as God creates alpha or God wills alpha are extrinsic predications. They are predications that are made true in virtue of God's relations or lack of relations to things outside God. Because God's act of creating alpha is identical to God, the identity approach affirms premise 12 of the argument for 8. But because this approach denies that God's act of creating alpha designates the same object in every world in which that object exists, it denies that God's act of creating alpha designates God rigidly, and so denies premise 11 of that argument. The extrinsic approach agrees with the identity approach in taking truths such as God creates alpha and other truths about God's acts bearing on creatures to be extrinsic predications, since they are true in virtue of God's relations or lack of relations to things outside God. But the extrinsic approach also takes the acts themselves to be extrinsic. On the extrinsic approach, Were God's act of creating Alpha to cease to exist by virtue of Alpha and its relation of dependence on God to cease to exist, were that to happen, it would leave God completely untouched, right? So it shows that God's act of creating Alpha is extrinsic, not intrinsic. The extrinsic approach thus rejects premise 12 of the argument for 8. On the other hand, the extrinsic approach accepts premise 11. The phrase on the extrinsic approach, the phrase God's act of creating Alpha does rigidly designate, because there is only one world in which that object exists. The only world in which God's act of creating Alpha exists is the actual world. The phrase God's act of creating Alpha refers to Alpha in that world and never refers to anything else. So on the extrinsic approach, the phrase God creates Alpha designates rigidly. So is the extrinsic approach plausible? Is it plausible to think of God's causal or creative activity as extrinsic to God? Well, no less a thinker than Aristotle, or even Jeff Brouwer, right? I would credit him with having the what you heard from earlier today was like, if you can believe it, was like half of a paper. There's a whole other half of that paper, which does a nice job, I think, defending a similar kind of approach. It's influenced me, so. I'm going to give credit where credit is due. No less a thinker than Aristotle thought that this idea of causal activity being extrinsic, that this was true of efficient causality in general, even apart from theological considerations. Aristotle, Aquinas, and others deem it a mistake in general to think that an agent's causal activity resides within the agent qua agent itself. When fire brings about heat in water, the fire's act of bringing about the heat and water is not in the fire. It is not the fire itself or some accident of the fire. Rather, the fire's causal act is simply the heat insofar as it depends on the fire as its source. The maxim here is the action of the agent is in the patient. Where is the action of the agent located? It's located in the patient. Some agents must undergo motion themselves in order to cause motion in other things, but the act of bringing about motion or any other effect is not any motion or entity within the agent, but is simply the effect depending on the agent as its cause. Given that it is arguably true of causal acts in general, it seems plausible to think of the act of creation as extrinsic to God. But what of God's acts of willing and knowing creatures? Could we say that these acts are also extrinsic to God? Could we say that these acts consist in relations between God and creatures, or that on the side of God, they involve just the divine substance, while on the side of the creature, willed or known, they involve a relation between the creature and God? Well, I am aware of no place where Thomas explicitly applies the actively-passively distinction to God's contingent willing and knowing of creatures. I think he would be sympathetic to the proposal that God's contingent willing and knowing is extrinsic to God. Support for this judgment can be found in his discussion of the divine names. There he says that names, quote, signifying his, God's, relation to creatures, names signifying God's relation to creatures manifestly do not at all signify his substance, but rather his relation to something else, or rather the relation of creatures to himself. Accordingly, if that's right, the expressions willing Alpha and knowing Alpha, since they signify relations to creatures, do not signify the divine substance. But since the only thing intrinsic to God is the divine substance, it follows that what these names signify is extrinsic. As Thomas tells us, they signify relations to things outside God. Similarly, at Summa Contra Gentilis, Book 12, Chapter 11, Aquinas notes a number of things said of God in relation to creatures, that God produces them, moves them, knows them, etc. Then he goes on in the following chapter to argue that such things do not exist in God. Quote, for they cannot exist in him as accidents in a subject, since there is no accident in him. Neither can they be God's very substance, because, as Aristotle says in the Categories, relative terms are those which in their very being refer somehow to something else, so that God's substance would have to be referred to something else. But that which is essentially referred to another depends on it in a certain way, since it can neither be nor be understood without it. Hence, it would follow that God's substance would depend on something else extrinsic to it, so that he would not be of himself the necessary being, as he was shown to be in Book 1. Notice that Aquinas is in effect responding to a variation of the modal collapse argument here. Given divine simplicity, God has no accidents, but one can't thereby identify God's contingent actions, actions relating to creatures, one can't identify them with the divine substance, for that would make the divine substance dependent on creatures and would rule out God's being of himself the necessary being. And notice that Aquinas' solution is not to say that while God's contingent acts bearing on creatures are identical to God, they are not necessarily identical. Rather, his solution is to deny that these things are in God, that these things are intrinsic to God. And I think that supports the extrinsic approach. But if God's contingent willing and knowing are not intrinsic to God, consisting either in the divine substance or divine accident, in what do they consist? One promising suggestion is that God's contingent willing of some effect might consist simply in his bringing about that effect on purpose or for a reason. And since the bringing about is extrinsic, so too would be the contingent willing, so if that's how it's understood. There are also extrinsic models of divine knowing on which God's knowing some creature is a kind of relation to that creature. And I think that these things they're plausible, promising approaches to understand not only God's creative action, his act of causing, but also his act of willing and knowing creatures to be understood and to be extrinsic. Okay. So let me just go to the conclusion there. I'm going to skip a few paragraphs just for the sake of time. The conclusion is not too long, but I want to make sure I get to it. So in this presentation, I have used the argument for 8 as a way to facilitate discussion of the options available to the theist who would like to reject the revised, valid version of the modal collapse argument and affirm both divine simplicity and divine freedom. The first option, which involves rejecting premise 10 and denying that the term God designates rigidly, led to serious difficulties and was quickly dismissed. The options represented by the identity approach, which rejects 11, and the extrinsic approach, which rejects 12, we have discussed at greater length. I have argued that there is significant textual support in Aquinas for the extrinsic approach. Aquinas' distinction between creation taken actively and creation taken passively invites a more nuanced reading of those passages in which Aquinas identifies all of God's activity with God. When the divine act in question is an act of creation, I submit that Aquinas' identification of the act with God is not talking about the act, creatio, the act of creation taken as a whole, but only about what the act involves on the side of the agent, God. Taken as a whole, the act consists not just in God, but also in the creature and its relation of dependence on God. The approach gains further support from Aquinas' teaching that names signifying God's relation to creatures do not signify the divine substance, but rather the relation of creatures to the divine substance. Thus, not only the designator, God's act of creating Alpha, but also God's act of willing Alpha, God's act of knowing, let's say that Alpha exists, and so on, are not simply identical to God, but include the creature with its relevant relation to God. Such divine acts taken as a whole are not identical to God, nor are they intrinsic to God. Rather, they are extrinsic on the extrinsic approach. In addition to enjoying textual support from St. Thomas, the extrinsic approach avoids what seemed to me the counterintuitive implications of the identity approach. On the extrinsic approach, unlike the identity approach, the truth values of propositions about God's activity that vary wildly across worlds reflect differences in that activity itself. Moreover, God's activity differs across worlds where his effects differ. As a result, he could really act or do otherwise than he does, rather than simply doing the same thing across worlds, but with different results. On the extrinsic approach, God's act of creating Alpha exists contingently Unlike on the identity approach, the object to which it refers does not exist in all possible worlds, but only in the world in which God creates Alpha. For this reason, God's act of creating Alpha can serve as the truth maker for God creates Alpha. That is, on the extrinsic approach, it can serve as the truth maker for God creates Alpha. It can't do so on the identity approach, since on that approach, the object to which God's act of creating Alpha refers exists in worlds where the proposition God creates Alpha is false. Finally, the extrinsic approach avoids the incongruity to which the identity approach is committed, that all the differences between a world in which God knows, wills, and creates Alpha and a world in which he doesn't are extrinsic to God, yet God's knowing, willing, and creating Alpha are intrinsic. The foregoing considerations strike me as reasons to favor the extrinsic approach, even though I still regard the identity approach as a viable option. I also think that it likely the differences between these two approaches have not always been clearly recognized. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.